All right. Accusation. This is where we're starting. All right. I think it's an incredibly powerful image in the Bible with Joshua standing before the Lord in his filthy garments. All right. Now, Joshua is the high priest. That's a big deal. Because not only is he himself in a position of tremendous authority and power, but he's the representative of God to the people. And the people to God. This is what the high priest is. This is why he's a picture of the church. This is why this is about the church. It's not just about one particular man who is filthy. This is about the people of God. All right. Think about the blasphemy involved as Joshua the high priest represents God before the people. Israel is called to be a kingdom of priests to the rest of the world. The world's supposed to look at Israel and say, this is what God's like. And what do they see? He is in filthy garments. The word is dung, it's excrement, really. He looks terrible. He smells worse. I mean, there's something visceral going on here about the way that Joshua, the high priest, is described here. And he's standing before the Lord. That's a problem. And Satan is standing at his, I assume that's referring to Joshua's right hand. Maybe it could go the other way, but I don't know that it matters. But anyway, accusing. All right. So what we have really is a courtroom. We have the defendant, if you will, Joshua. We have the accuser, the prosecutor, standing before the judge. Do you remember? Do you remember the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8? This woman is utterly humiliated. Yeah. Okay. She maybe brought some of this on herself. The guy's not there. By the way, though, the death penalty in Leviticus was for adultery included the man and the woman. So the fact that the woman in John 8, and read it at some point, is not there is telling. This is a setup. Okay. I mean, you know what? This is not. Let me go ahead and read this because it is so helpful. This is John chapter 8. Early in the morning, John 8 verse 2. Early in the morning, Jesus came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" They said this to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." All right, so you have this woman, you know, standing in all her humiliation. You have the Pharisees who are effectively prosecuting her, marshaling the law, saying, "What should we do?" They're appealing to Jesus as a judge. And Jesus acts like a judge, doesn't he? But it's very interesting what he does. You know, one of the things that amazes me about Jesus is how incredibly smart he is. I mean, I don't know if you think of him that way, but look at all the ways in which you know, the Pharisees try to put him in a hole. And not only does he get out of the hole, but he tells them exactly what they need to hear. Oh, you who are bringing this woman in adultery, which one of you is going to throw the stone? And who knows what he was writing, by the way, in the sand. We don't know. All right. But in the end, they're seeking, the Pharisees are accusing this woman. But really what they're trying to do is actually accuse Jesus. That's who they're after. They don't really care much about the woman. She's collateral damage. Right. What they want is to get Jesus to say, stone her or don't stone her. And either way, that's a problem for Jesus. And Jesus turns it around, you know, and suddenly they become the defendants. He's the prosecutor. And they're judged, at least at this point, it seems like, by their own consciences, because they just bleed off. Accusation is so thick in our world. It's everywhere. This has been the most convicting thing for me in going through Zechariah 3, is thinking about all the ways in which my own heart lays blame and accuses, and it's remarkable. It's everywhere. Accusation has an appropriate part, by the way, in life. Israel had a system of courts, so you know, if you were wronged, you know, you could come to the judge or the priest. They actually work together, you know, and have wrongs redressed. So accusation isn't always wrong. There's a way in which it can be healthy. You know, righteousness and justice are the foundation of the Lord's throne. And one of the ways that those things are upheld is by matters being settled, you know. And so it's not always wrong, and we'll get to it in a second. But it often can be. All right, so Satan is accusing Joshua the high priest. I want to take a look at accusation. And I want to look at the two places in the Old Testament where Satan acts as the accuser explicitly. All right. One is in Genesis 3, and the second is in the book of Job. We won't spend a lot of time in Genesis 3. I think it's, you all know the story. In the end, the serpent comes along and effectively starts accusing God. That's really all he's doing in Genesis 3. He comes along and says, has God said you can't eat of any tree in the garden? And, you know, of course the Lord didn't say that at all. He gave him the run of the whole place, with the exception of one tree. Freely eat from every tree. It was a command, actually. Go eat your ice cream. That's what he's basically saying. It's a blessing. But Satan ends up taking how do you want to say it? He asks a question that's meant to lead them somewhere. He's not asking anything. He's planting a suggestion. God said you can't eat of any tree in the garden. All right. In the end, you know, Eve knows the command, but kind of doesn't, and we don't need to go into all that right now. But the serpent ends up saying, look, God is not for you. He knows that if you eat of the tree, you'll be like him. And besides that, you won't surely die. It's an idle threat. You know. In other words, God is not who you think he is. And if you really want to live life and life abundantly, eat of the tree. That's how sin works. it really is that simple. You know, we think we know better. Besides, God's not paying attention, and the wages of sin really isn't death. And so we end up going our own way. But the point is that in Genesis 3, Satan is accusing God. That's what he does. He may also be accusing Adam and Eve, like, oh, are you guys stupid? I mean, really? He's duping you. The Lord is. Eat of the tree. Anyway, that may be an inference, but he's certainly accusing God. The second place in the Old Testament is the book of Job. We won't read through this. I assume that you all are somewhat familiar, at least with the first two chapters. The whole book, by the way, is really helpful. It's not an easy book, and you all know that. But at the same time, it is well worth spending time in. Let me read a couple of lines, though. This is from Job. It's on the front end of Psalms, and I will read from chapter 1, verse 6. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. So just like in Zechariah, Satan has access to the courts of the Lord. I don't know how to explain that, but that is what it is. Basically, in the next two chapters, Satan says, well, you know what? Of course. I mean, you've made life cushy for him. Of course he's going to be faithful and upright and whatever. But if you begin to stress him, then he'll curse you. And so the Lord says, okay, go ahead. Don't touch him, his body. But you can bring him to grief, effectively. And so Job ends up, losing his children, his livelihood, you know the story. Job does not curse the Lord. Satan comes back for a second cycle and says, well, just because, you know, let me at him. Let me touch his skin. Then he'll curse you. Okay. So, and he doesn't. We know that. All right. So Satan is accusing Job. Okay. Now, for the rest of the book, Satan doesn't go away. All right, we don't hear from him again, but his work continues in the three friends. All right, three friends come, and they actually start well. They sit with Job for a week and don't say anything. That's not a bad move. But then they begin to, they decide to do some pastoral counseling. And effectively, what they do is say, Job, you must have sinned somewhere, because we know that that God doesn't punish the upright. So repent. I mean, that's basically, in a nutshell, all they're saying. All right. I'll give you, this is Zophar from Job 11. For you say, he accuses Job, my doctrine is pure. I am clean in God's eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Now, of course, now we, of course, have already heard the Lord himself saying that he is blameless and upright, a fear of God, and shuns evil. All right, so we know this, we can see this for what it is. All right, so they're accusing Job. Oh, not they're accusing, yeah, they're accusing Job. That's what Satan does. But in a deeper way, they're accusing God. Okay, how is this? Well, the friends misrepresent him in a huge way. All right. Now, this is, I think this is Bildad. Not exactly sure. But anyway, as for me, this is their solution. I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty, so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as the night. But he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth. Well, that doesn't sound too bad, does it, actually? I mean, in some ways, that's you can find all of that in the scriptures. And so you read that and you think, oh my gosh, well, what's the problem here? Well, God, at the end of the book, says to Eliphaz, that's who said this, to Eliphaz and his friends, you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. All right, so my question at this point is, what was wrong with that? That sounded all good. Okay. The problem isn't sometimes what we say, but what we leave out. In the book of Exodus, there is a line that the scriptures never get over. It's the most complete description of the Lord's character to be found anywhere in the Bible. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, forgiving iniquities, transgressions, and sins, who will by no means clear the guilty. All right. And the Psalms, the prophets, even places in the New Testament are quoting this. David in particular in the Psalms quotes this verbatim. Okay. But it's the longest description of God's character to be found anywhere in the Bible.
Where's that?
Exodus 34:6. what the friends are doing. They know nothing of the God who is merciful and gracious. That's not to say that anything that Eliphaz said in the section that I just read is wrong. But what are they not saying? Especially, what are they not saying that Job needs to hear? Job knows about the mercy of the Lord. And we know that. Why? Because he's complaining that the Lord is not extending it to him. Why aren't you being merciful to me? I mean, you know, and we know, you know, we can sympathize with Job's complaints. But the point is that he understands that God is a God of mercy. And that allows him to say, where are you? This is who you've said you are. This is who I know you to be. All right. The three friends don't have any clue about this. They're misrepresenting God, you know, at this point. In other words, they're setting up this simplistic dichotomy, okay? Do good, God will bless you. Do bad, God will curse you. This sort of almost mechanical understanding of who God is, you know, which is not true to his character. And so they're setting him up, implying that that God is like, it's sort of like he's big, sort of big K karma in the sky. So that's the first way they accuse God. All right, here's the second way. They call on Job to trust not in God, but in himself. All right, listen to Eliphaz here. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? How would you respond to that? I hope you would say no. My fear of God is not my confidence. The integrity of my ways, it better not be my hope. Or here's Bildad. If you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. He's basically encouraging Job to trust in himself. Get your integrity in order, and things will be well for you. Job, on the other hand, he knows God. Job 7, why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? That's a legitimate question from one who knows that God is like this. That's what he does. Or chapter 9, behold, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. And yet he holds on to the God he knows is for him, even though he doesn't know where he is. I mean, do you get this? Maybe you do. If you ever want to get a handle on the book of Job, there is a brilliant song written by Michael Card called Job Suite. You can find it on YouTube. Listen to it. Job was a mystery. It's still a mystery to me, whatever. But that song did more than anything else to sort of clear the fog away from the book of Job for me. And I love the way that Card, he basically is condensing the scriptures, what Job is saying, into his own verse. You know, he's writing a song. And so this is from Job. I know my advocate waits upon high. My witness in heaven sees the tears that I cry. A true intercessor who will condescend to plead with God as a man pleads for his friend. That's a very faithful rendering of Job 16, by the way. But did you hear him? Job at this point? He knows him, even though he seems to be absent. But the point is that Satan continues his work in the three friends. They accuse Job of being in sin, and they accuse God of being somebody that's like the cosmic Santa Claus that's, you know, has a list, he's checking it twice, and you better up your game if you want presents. Not who he is. Now, Satan has an ally in his accusation. And that's God's law. Satan doesn't have to reach very far, you know. Not for any of us. I mean, he's got plenty of evidence, doesn't he? I mean, with you?
Yeah.
Not hard to come by. He uses the law. Okay. And goodness gracious, I mean, of course that's effective, because who measures up to it? I mean, we know this. All right, but here's the thing, he perverts it. All right, so let me say a couple of things about law so that we can understand this right, because it is because I think the probably the biggest plague that we deal with, you know, in the church, meaning us, is just being legalists.
Yes.
You know. Mm-hmm. Because we don't understand God, and therefore we don't understand his law or his word. All right. So I want to set a few things in order. There is law. Do this, don't do this. Ten Commandments. All right. Then there's covenant. I will be your God, you will be my people. All right. All right. A covenant is effectively a relationship. That's what the Lord offered Adam and Eve in the garden, right? All right. Trust me. I walk with you in the cool of the day, and I'm providing for your needs. And what do I want? I want you. That's what he wants. All right. So it's a covenant right there. All right. Now, having said that, relationships have rules. They always do, by the way. I mean, when I teach in a class, all right, there are rules there. I have a relationship with students, all right. On my part, you know, the expectation, the unwritten rule, is to know what I'm talking about, to grade fairly, to respect the in class, you know, not to make people feel stupid or whatever. I mean, you know, these are unwritten rules, but they're real. You know, students likewise, don't cheat. You know, do your own work or whatever. I mean, the point is that we have rules. In nearer relationships, the rules are really important. So here's one of the laws in my home. One that is as inviolable, whatever. Unyielding is that of the Medes and the Persians. I take out the trash. If you're a husband, you don't take out the trash. You don't need to feel, maybe you ought to, but you don't need to. This is my home. I'm not commenting on anybody else's home. All right. Lauren doesn't require it of me. We've just gotten into that. That's what I do. All right. She doesn't require it. The marriage requires it, though. In other words, the law, take out the trash, serves the covenant. All right. Here's another one. This actually, I'm going to take this from Paul. This is 1 Corinthians 7. And this is a marital issue that he's dealing with. All right. Paul says, using, by the way, the common Greek word for debt or duty, says this: the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. All right. Paul is not suggesting that the husband demands from the wife or the wife demands from the husband. That's not what he's saying. He's saying each should give to the other. Okay? All right. Not because the wife requires it or the husband requires it, but the marriage requires it. The law serves the covenant. And you come up with 1,000 of these things. Okay? All right. In other words, law is given, God's law is given not for the sake of do this, don't do this, you know, whatever, as if it's a matter of just simply doing the right thing. Okay? It serves the covenant. And if we break those things apart, then yeah, God's every bit the miser that Satan said he was in the Garden of Eden. He's just trying to keep you down by telling you to do this and not do this. You know, I mean, his whole thing was God doesn't care about you. The law has nothing to do with the covenant, if you want to use those terms. All right. And so Satan misconstrues the law so that God will appear to be a dictator, even a control freak. We're called to friendship with God, to walk with him in the cool of the day. And that has form. It has rules. You know, my marriage has rules. It may be a little bit different than yours. But the point is that they're there, you know, and you know what they are, whether they're spoken or unspoken.